In Waterford in the late 70s and into the 80s was a pretty depressed place. We'd had a lot of job closures. There wasn't a music scene as such. There were cabaret bands, cover bands. We had the ballroom in Tremore and a ballroom in the city where the show bands would come. But there really wasn't any great music scene. And there certainly wasn't, as you know, any radio. And this story is probably told a thousand times over across the world, across the country. But in Waterford, we would have, and I would have, listened to the likes of Radio Caroline, 208, Luxembourg, BBC One, in the early 70s. I can distinctly remember Tin Lizzy playing in the Ardrey Hotel, which looks over the city of Waterford, and it coming across to me. So, but we wouldn't have had a music scene. So we were aware to our friends, who were friends of mine who did their leaving in 77, went to college. I used to go to Dublin. For Waterford people, going to Dublin is a reasonably common enough thing. You would head to Dublin for the scene, for the nightlife. So we were aware there were pirates in Dublin. And then in 1979, a guy called Rick Whelan, who was a local DJ in Waterford's only nightclub, opened a radio station in his farm out in Killotter, in his dad's farm. And his brother Des Whelan, who's now the chief executive of WLRFM and of Beat FM, they set up a radio station with a guy called Edio Gianni, who was an Italian. All three went to school in Water Park, where I went to school. We all went to school together. They set up a station. And a few of us who were involved in youth work, I'd left school at the stage. I was working in a place called Milton Bradley Ireland, MB Ireland. They made games like Operation and whatever. I was in the purchasing department. I had declined to go to college for a range of reasons when I left school, although I'd intended to go and do politics and history to do journalism, but I ended up staying in Waterford. We tried to set up a station called Radioactive Waterford. We bought all the gear. I think they were called Citronic decks, or mixers. We put all the gear together. The transmitter was the problem. We found a TV engineer around the corner from me in Thomas Street. I lived in the centre of town, who agreed to rewind the transmitter, the transformer, the modulation transformer, from a ship's transmitter that had come ashore on the beach in Tremore. And he had taken the ship's transmitter, and he'd agreed to rewind it for us. We got a 257 crystal cut in England, but we couldn't get the damn thing to work. We tried to broadcast from a place called Ballymacaw, which overlooks the sea at Dunmore East, near Dunmore East, between Dunmore East and Tremore. So that didn't work. And at the same time, Jack O'Keefe, who was a DJ with WLR, went to school with Des and Ricky and myself and others who were in Waterpark together, decided to open an alternative called Shoreside beside the River Shore. And they asked me would I come on board, and a couple of others who were involved in the aborted attempt to launch Radioactive Waterford, or RAW. So that's how I got involved. And I used to leave my job in Milton Bradley and drive, and I was 19 at this stage. I would have been about 19 going on 20. I would leave at 5:15, drive across the town, which wasn't difficult in those days, to the north side of the River Shore, to a farmhouse just around the corner from the city, from Cromwell's Rock, where we had our studio. And I'd do 6 to 7:30. And the program was kind of pop music, rock music, and interviewing youth groups, young people, my own age, really. I was very involved in youth work. So that went on for about 10 months. And then I was asked by WLR, would I come across to join clearly the bigger of the two stations.
And just before you talk about WLR, was Shoreside then a more community station, or was it kind of a hybrid operation? What did it sound like?
It presented itself more as a community station, and it certainly advertised itself as that. I'm not sure that it was much different, to be honest to you, than WLR when you look back on it. And I have some of the old recordings. I don't think there was a great deal of difference. I think there was personality issues, maybe at the top of the organisations, you know. But I do remember from that era, that was the era of the raids. They were happening pretty fast, thick and heavy. So WLR would get raided 1 week and we'd get raided the next week. And I distinctly remember driving to Dublin in my father's car to pick up a replacement transmitter from, to this day, I'm pretty sure was an employee of the Post and Telegraphs, who was probably involved in seizing one of the transmitters in the first place.
So you were going to take it back, were you?
We went to Dublin and picked it up at, just outside the GPO, and brought it back to Waterford and went back on air. That happened a couple of times. They cut down the masts a couple of times, and we all mucked in to put them back up together again, and all the rest of it.
So were you there for any of the raids then? Were you actually present?
Raids tended to happen during the day, so I was never there for a raid. I was working at a day job. So I missed out on the raids. But it was, when you think back on it, and I ended up in a career in broadcasting, how slipshod, how on the back of a piece of paper it was, you know. But there are great stories, and they're in those books. I mean, we didn't even have the wherewithal to make commercials. In Shoreside, we had to shut down the station to make commercials to run. And I distinctly remember, because I got into running bands, I used to book bands. It was there was nothing in the town. And then the Showboat, which is a pub in the Glen in Waterford, decided it would run a rock night on Wednesday nights. So I got involved in booking bands for that. And in fact, had I became notorious, I suppose, for it in our world. But I got involved in booking bands, and I brought U2 to play in the regional college for the princely sum of £300. But we did lots of bands, right? And so I would do that on a Wednesday night. I'd do them, bring them back and play them. But I had Horslips playing what was to be their last gig in the Waterford area in 1980. And we had to close the station at Christmas to make ads. And I was in making an ad in the studio proper. What I didn't know was that they had turned on the transmitter, which is in the room behind me, which I couldn't see. And the whole city heard the make and remake and multiple remakes of the Horslips ad with plenty of expletives, because they kept intruding to say to me, listen, your drink is going warm, and because it was Christmas. That went on, and apparently the whole city was in stitches listening to this thing. But that kind of nonsense happened.
So was it fairly low power then? Was it a low? Do you know anything about the technical side of things? How strong was the transmitter? I presume it was just AM, was it?
It was only AM. And well, there's a story around going FM. It's only AM initially. We were on 257, and WLR was on 252, I think. It couldn't have been more than a couple of kilowatt. It was quite weak. It only really, and same for WLR, we only really reached a 15-mile radius around the city, out to Tramore, Dunmore, Kilmacthomas, and that was about it. And Shoreside would have been weaker than WLR. The story of FM is around about the same period, again around the 1980s. There was a guy came down from Dublin. I'm sure many of the Dublin people here today will probably know the guy I'm talking about. I don't remember his name. But he came down from Dublin to build an FM transmitter. And we were going to move the studio from the country on the north shore of the river looking into the city. We were going to go to a higher point, Ballybricken, which is the hill smack in the centre of Waterford, to put the FM transmitter up on a height. And a guy came down from Dublin to build it for us and spent 3 days building and failing to get it to work. But he spent the same 3 days living on cough mixture, and we're pretty sure that he obviously had a drug habit of some sort. It failed dismally, but I remember him being horsed back to Dublin on the train by the guy who owned the radio station, because it was an absolute failure. But I mean, there were these mad stories when you think about it. So I moved to WLR.
When would that have been?
That would have been in early 1980s. Okay. They had decided that they were going to clean up the act, professionalise, and go for the licence. And as you know, there were several attempts by various ministers to get that moving, and it never happened. I left WLR subsequently in 1987 through a public competition to end up working in RT in the newsroom. Initially on 2FM News, and then staying there until 1994 as a journalist. But I had gone full time. I had gone with a job to Apple Computers in Cork in 1985. I had been working part time, mainly weekend work or nighttime work, late night programming, mainly music, but with a certain amount of interviews, band interviews, interviews with visiting bands when they were available, an opportunity to the job folded in Cork. I was coming back to Waterford. Des said, listen, we want to launch a news service properly. Will you come back? Initially, I came back, did a bit of work in the newsroom, worked selling ads, but it went full time. It was a major cut in salary. It went from the princely sum of 13,500 in Apple down to something like about 5,500 or 6,000 to work for WLR. It opened the door, and there's no doubt about it. We made a determined decision to get the news service into a shape that would be acceptable in terms of assessing the organisation for the future.
How did you do that?
Well, okay, the first problem was we couldn't get an NUJ card. And in those days, particularly, the NUJ card was a passport to an interview. And the local journalists in the Southeast branch of the NUJ had effectively put a black on anybody, a blacking or a ban on anybody working in local radio, being not allowing them interview people who work in politics. So in other words, all the TDs, well, initially in the very early days, were very happy they used to take out ads. I remember particularly a European election campaign where Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael both advertised with WLR. That stopped. And then the interviews with the local TDs stopped on foot of pressure from the local branch of the NUJ, mainly, and from the local papers, the owners of the local papers. So we couldn't get to the main source of news in political life anyway. So we had to find other ways around it. And there was a lot of plagiarism. There's no question about that. News stories would be run, typed from the RTE bulletin or typed from the front page of the local paper. And when I came in, you know, I had a friend who had worked with me in Shoreside under the alias of Dave James, who had gone on to work as Jerry Foley, which is his real name, in Today FM. Today Tonight with Joe Mulholland in RTE, and had been very successful, and had ended up working as a political correspondent with TVAM in Belfast during the height of it in the 80s. And with a bit of help from Jerry and others, we began a program of trying to make our news service acceptable, and that meant immediately ending the lifting of material. So if we did lift, we credited it. So bulletins went from a news bulletin which just copied what was in the local paper to a report along the lines of, it says in the Munster Express today that, right?
How did Munster Express take to that? Did they object? Or
well, they couldn't really, because it was effectively advertising their paper for them for free. So it worked. And we gradually, over a period of time, began the process of tidying up the news service. But I was working full-time, and trying to get into the NUJ was the problem. They didn't want to let us in because they didn't see us as legitimate. By that stage in the 80s, in the middle 80s, in Dublin, the branches in Dublin, the PNPR branch, had begun to accept pirate radio news people into the union.
From Radio Nova.
From Radio Nova and elsewhere in Dublin, yeah. And they had come into the union. So Barry McCall, who was a very active member of the NUJ in Dublin in that branch, he was branch chair, came down to a local meeting in Waterford, and we went through about three meetings, and I had to bring all my work and my tapes and my transcripts, and on three occasions I was turned down. And finally, after Jerry Foley came from London, or from Belfast, and these were all established members of the NUJ at this stage, they came down to vouch for me, and I got in. So I was going to my second branch meeting in not long after. This would have been in 87. It took me from 85 to 87 to get into the union. And I had a certain smile on my face at the second meeting, because I was actually coming to figure out how do I transfer from the South East branch to the RTE Dublin Broadcasting branch, because I got a job in RTE.
But the important thing is that you got into the NUJ still in WLR.
And I was still in WLR, and I had been there for full-time for 2.5 years and got in eventually. And there was, at that stage, a loosening of the relationship between local papers and the station. I think the writing was on the wall. This was now 87. If you think about it, it was 2 years later that the Act was being put into effect. So there was a thawing of the relationship, an improvement of the relationship with the working journalists, a recognition that we were now crediting them and not ignoring the fact that they had actually produced this work. And that helped. And I think to a degree that was, without being too big-headed about it, partly my influence, because we had, and Des's, we had made a decision that we were going to go legit, that we wanted to get the license. It happened for me that I managed to get a job in RTE before that all happened. And ironically, or maybe deliberately, I happened to be working for Morning Ireland on the evening that the stations closed. So the next morning I had put together a package for to mark the closure of the local stations across the country. And in fact, the station we used as one of the examples was WLR in Waterford. So I have all the material from the closure of that day. And it was a big development. And they went on, WLR, to become the station of a record in Waterford since then, and gone on to great success.
Indeed, they were one of the few pirates that essentially became licensed as they were. I think Midwest Radio in Mayo was the other example in 1989 as well.
And I think that's attributed to the fact that the station, under Des's leadership, and I like to think it had some small part to play in it, that we deliberately set out to create a professional operation that had its roots in the mayhem of the late 70s, but had made that journey to respectability and to being professional.
Do you think, was WLR then, just looking more generally at the station, was it more community focused or more commercial in its focus, or was it a kind of a hybrid?
It was a hybrid. It had a very clear community focus. It always had a substantial mid-morning programme that featured, because we couldn't get the local politicians. Maybe in a way it was a positive thing. Because we couldn't get local politicians, we had to go with local organisations, local groups, and to give them a voice. So in many ways, that might have been part of its success. The very fact that small pressure groups or representative groups or self-help groups knew they could get airtime in WLR to talk about their problems. Whereas maybe if we had been able to broadcast the full range of political coverage, we might have ignored those organisations in favour of the local TD. So in a way, a relationship was built between the station and the groups in the communities, the youth groups, the football teams, the rugby teams, people that were day-to-day ordinary folk, not in national politics or local politics, but maybe people who had were doing a lot in their own time and voluntarily for people. They got a voice. And maybe that's what stood to WLR when the time came. So that's a valid point, I think, going forward in terms of how the station decided it would tap into the community. It had some really quirky things. For instance, there was the woman is dead now, but Mother Eukaria used to do the rosary on WLR at 7 every evening. And I used to come on at 7 o'clock. This went on from the very early days. It was that Des and Rick believed that, you know, they would try and tap into the older community. So there was a woman called a nun called Mother Eukaria from the Order of Mercy nuns in Waterford. Every night, Monday to Friday, did a decade of the rosary. And those of us in studio had to pray along to do the response. Now, I was only thinking about this last night. I was thinking about stories and saying, you know, I actually remember this well because the receptionist come newsreader used to sit in with her to do the response. But she would give you the eye across the table to expect you to respond. So I used to do the response as well. But what she didn't know was I had the slider down. So it didn't go out on air. Because I'm afraid it wasn't my cup of tea at all. But
every
night, Monday to Friday, and that went on. I'm sure right up to the woman, as I say, has deceased quite some time. Hugely popular woman in Waterford, it has to be said. I mean, it wasn't just any old nun. Mother Eukaria was well known in the city. But it was a particular, and if you Des did attempt to take it off the air, and there were actually protests to the station to have it restored. There was a lobby of a small protest to the station door to have her returned. Yeah.
So, what difference do you think the station made to the city?
Waterford is an interesting town, and I'm very conscious of living here in Dublin for the last 30 years. Waterford sees itself as being the forgotten city out of the five, and it certainly felt that way in the 70s. It was a bleak. We had a port dispute that went on for 8 years, so there hadn't been any ships coming into the port, which was a major part of our industry in Waterford and industrial life. Waterford Glass was still strong in the 80s. It was a very strong trade union centre, but it was a bleak town. There was quite a bit of unemployment. The city was quite grey, and WLR and Shoreside and ABC, which came along subsequently, and other smaller pirates that came around, there was Crystal City Sound and a range of others, they all brought a bit of life to the city because most of them were local people, so the local community. And in that radio station was spring up a city that felt pretty bad in the 70s and 80s.